A few people are putting fresh flowers and wreaths there. One or two are crying. The prospect stretches out beyond this gathering into the grey vastness of London, where people are now crowded as they have never been crowded before, whose food is dear and employment more uncertain than it has ever been. But let not the spectacle be one of unrelieved gloom. Regent Street, Oxford Street, and Bond Street are bright with shoppers and congested with new automobiles, because we must remember that everybody doesn't lose by a war. Beyond London, the country sinks into night, and across the narrow sea are North France and Belgium devastated. Germany, with scores of thousands of her infants dwindling and dying for want of milk. All Austria starving. Half the population of Vienna, it's believed, unless American relief comes quickly, is doomed to die of hardship before the spring. Beyond that bleak twilight stretches the darkness of Russia. There, at least, no rich people are buying anything, and no military men are reading essays on the next war. But in icy Petrograd is little food, little wood, and no coal. All the towns of Russia, southward as far as the snow reaches, are in a similar plight, and in the Ukraine, and to the south, a ragged and dingy war drags to its end. Europe is bankrupt, and people's pockets rustle with paper money whose purchasing power dwindles as they walk about with it. But now we'll return to Sir Lewis, in the well-lit room at the United Service Institution. He was of the opinion, we follow the report in next morning's Times, that we were merely on the eve of the most extensive modifications of the art of war known to history. It behooved us, therefore, us being, of course, the British, and not the whole of mankind, to get on with our armaments and to keep ahead. A fine opening generalization. It was necessary to develop new arms. The nation which best did so would have a great advantage in the next war. There were people who were crying aloud for a reduction of armaments. But there, the director of trench warfare and supplies was wrong. They were just crying at the cenotaph, poor, soft, and stupid souls, because a son or a brother or a father was dead. Sir Lewis believed that one of the greatest developments in the art of warfare would be brought about in mechanical transport. The tank he treated with ingratitude. These military gentlemen are ungrateful to an invention which shoved and butted them into victory almost in spite of themselves. The tank, said Sir Lewis, was a freak. The outstanding feature of the tank, he said, was that it made mechanical transport independent of the roads. Hitherto, armies on the march had only been able to spoil the roads. Now their transport on caterpillar wheels would advance in open order on a broad front, carrying guns, munitions, supplies, bridging equipment, rafts, and men, and incidentally ploughing up and destroying hedges, ditches, fields, and cultivation generally. Armies would wallow across the country, leaving nothing behind but dust and mud. So our imaginations are led up to the actual hostilities. Sir Lewis was in favour of gas. For punitive expeditions particularly, gas was to be recommended. And here he startled and disconcerted his hearers by a gleam of something approaching sentimentality. It might be possible, he said, to come to some agreement that no gas should be used, which caused unnecessary suffering. But there his heart spoke rather than his head. It should have been clear to him that if law can so far override warfare as to prohibit any sort of evil device whatever, it can override warfare to the extent of prohibiting it altogether. And where would Sir Lewis Jackson and his audience be then? War is war. Its only law is the law that the maximum destruction of the forces of the enemy is necessary. To that law, in warfare, all considerations of humanity and justice are subordinate. From gas, Sir Lewis passed to the air. Here he predicted most important advances. We need not trouble ourselves yet with flying destroyers or flying concrete forts, but in 20 years' time the Air Force estimates might be the most important part of our preparations for war. He discussed the conversion of commercial flying machines to bombing and reconnaissance uses and the need for special types of fighting machine in considerable numbers and always ready. He gave reasons for supposing that the bombers in the next war would not have the same targets near the front of the armies and would secure better results by going further afield and bombing the centers where stores are being manufactured and troops trained. As everyone who stayed in London, or the east of England, in 1917 to 1918 knows, this means the promiscuous bombing of any and every centre of population. But of course the bombing of those prentice days would be child's play to the bombing of the next war. There would be countless more aeroplanes, bigger and much nastier bombs. Sir Lewis, proceeding with the sketch, mentioned the destruction of the greater part of London as a possible incident in the coming struggle, and so on to the culminating moral that the highest pay, the utmost importance, the freest expenditure must be allowed to military gentlemen. The expense entailed is in the nature of an absolutely necessary insurance, with which his particular audience warmly agreed. And a certain Major General Stone, a little forgetful of the source of his phrases, said he hoped that this lecture may be the beginning not of trusting in the League of Nations, but in our own right hand and our stretched-out arm. But we'll not go on with the details of this dream, for indeed no utopia was ever so impossible as this forecast of a world in which scarcely anything but very carefully sandbagged and camouflaged GHQ would be reasonably safe, in which countless bombers would bomb the belligerent lands incessantly, and great armies with lines of caterpillar transport roll to and fro, churning the fields of the earth into blood-streaked mud. There's not energy enough and no will whatever left in the world for such things. Generals who can't foresee tanks can't be expected to foresee or understand world bankruptcy. Still less are they likely to understand the limits imposed upon military operations by the fluctuating temper of the common man. Apparently these military authorities of the United Service Institution didn't even know that warfare aims at the production of states of mind in the enemy and is sustained by states of mind. The chief neglected factor in the calculations of Sir Lewis is the fact that no people whatever will stand such warfare as he contemplates, not even the people on the winning side. For as northern France, southeastern Britain, and north Italy now understand, the victor in the next war may be bombed and starved almost as badly as the loser. A phase is possible in which a war-tormented population may cease to discriminate between military gentlemen on this side or that, and may be moved to destroy them as the common enemies of the race. The Great War of 1914-18 was the culmination of the military energy of the Western populations, and they fought and fought well, because they believed they were fighting the war to end war. They were. German imperialism, with its organized grip upon education, and its close alliance with an aggressive commercialism, was beaten and finished. The militarism and imperialism of Britain and France and Italy are, by comparison, feeble, disorganized, and disorganizing survivals. They are things left over by the Great War. They have no persuasive power. They go on for sheer want of wits to leave off. No European government will ever get the same proportion of its people into the ranks and into its munition works again as the governments of 1914-18 did. Our world is very weak and feeble still in 1920, but its war fever is over. Its temperature is, if anything, subnormal. It's doubtful if it will take the fever again for a long time. The alterations in the conditions of warfare are already much profounder than such authorities as Sir Lewis Jackson suspect.